Welcome back to Life of Bi. It's been a while.
Yeah. We thought we would be able to make an episode while we were doing our stage show.
But we were wrong. That's actually the second time we've been wrong about that. So maybe we'll learn in future that we just can't do them at the same time.
Yeah.
Partly it's due to exhaustion and partly it's due to the fact that, like, we do this very intense thing together in the evenings, and that means that spending time apart in the days is actually crucial to the health of ourselves and the show, wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
So the idea of sitting down to have to do admin together
is actually awful.
It's actually awful.
Reprehensible.
And like the rest of the time, it doesn't feel like that. I'm Mary.
Oh, I'm Elle.
And this is...
This is Life of Bi.
Normally a podcast about the history of bisexuality. Today, however...
We're doing a slightly different...
Yes.
Thing again. We wanted, so if you'll remember, our last episode
was about Carol.
About Carol and our new, like, cultural thing, which I've come up with a name for.
Yeah, give it. You've forgotten it.
No, I remember. I just can't remember if it has the at the front. Is it the, or is it just,
Deliver it both.
Okay. Bisection. Or... The bisection.
I think it's the bisection.
The bisection.
You could do insert name of cultural thing, yeah. Colon, bisected.
Yeah, no, that's good.
We did the one on Carol.
We did Carol bisected.
And this month was meant to be, we're going to start with...
Solidarity.
Yeah, and again. Lesbians and gays for minors, which we've started working on.
You'll be pleased to know.
And we were going to record that today, but then Elle started to feel really ill.
Listen, guys, my tonsils are the size of a golf ball. Two golf balls. And I don't know what it is. I feel like I'm always ill when we record this podcast. There are two answers to that. I'm always ill is one of them. The second one is that I'm allergic to the podcast, but that doesn't make sense because I really enjoy doing it. We have podcaster guilt.
Because when we look at other podcasts, yeah, why not?
Yeah, we'll talk about this.
When we look at other podcasts, right, it's so easy to be like...
They release one a week?
Yeah, they have these amazing guests on. How do they keep it so regular? They always do an Instagram post. What me and Elle forget is it's literally just us. That's why it's difficult.
That's why we're a shambles, guys. And, like, I think you guys get it. I mean, it's funny because some people came to see the show who listened to the podcast.
Yeah, thank you for doing that. That was so nice.
So nice to meet you all. It made me feel really nice. But I was a bit like, well, people are listening.
People are listening.
People are real.
And you must be a patient bunch because
we're useless.
We're pretty erratic, is what I'd say. Useless. We're not useless, Elle.
We're just here by
accident. Use some more kind language.
Sorry. I'm feeling, you know, yep.
You've got, you know, the sense of impending doom.
I've got a sense of impending doom. I emailed my therapist, who I haven't seen for a year, this morning, and she just replied.
That's excellent.
And I think I've been even nervous about that.
Elle has a line in the show, which is that I must go back to therapy. You say, I must go back to therapy, and I vow to go back to therapy in the same show.
Twice.
And they said it every single day in August and every single day in January, and they still hadn't done it.
And I did this morning.
Yeah. And I sort of, every so often, I drop another subtle hint that I think it'd be a really good idea. We'll be talking about
it's
something
not very
emotional.
Subtle,
well, I just say, you
it's
know,
subtle.
I sort of giving you some advice. I'm like, obviously, I'm not a therapist, but you could go back to therapy.
Yeah, and Mary did that today.
And I did that today, and it worked.
Yep.
Oh my God.
Oh, your voice went so high then. It was amazing.
I just was like, it was so surprising. You know?
I know, it just...
So
how
gratifying.
How many times does it take for the penny to finally drop? I mean, let's do it mathematically. We did about 30 performances in August. I think I had to say it about 60 times out loud for me to actually act upon it. Anyway.
That's very human.
So, this is all to say, we're not going to critique ourselves for being bad podcasters. We're not bad podcasters. We're just occasional podcasters.
We're just humans.
We're humans.
And this isn't our only job, and Audible isn't funding us, and we don't have a studio, and etc., etc., etc.
If Audible came and said they were going to fund us, would we accept?
What an interesting...
People would have to subscribe to Audible then. I don't think we could do it.
I also wouldn't want to be... They would tell us what to do as well. And one of the things I love about this podcast is...
Being able to do whatever we want.
Being able to do whatever we want.
Yep.
Well, speaking of, should we just do whatever we want and talk about all of our strangers?
This is All of Our Strangers Bisected. Okay, it goes without saying that this is going to have spoilers in it. So if you haven't watched this film, just stop.
Wait until you've seen it and then come back later.
Come back later and do go and see it.
All of Us Strangers is a 2023 British romantic fantasy film, is what people have been calling it.
Interesting.
Written and directed by Andrew Hay and based on the 1987 novel Strangers by Taichi Yamada. It is the second feature adaptation of the novel.
Great.
That's all we need to know. Now, and it stars, obviously...
Andrew Scott.
Paul Mescal. Claire Foy. And that other guy who was great in it.
I've forgotten his name.
Jamie Bell.
He plays Billy Elliot.
Does he?
Yeah.
Is that who he is?
That's who he is.
Oh, my
God. He's a great actor, you know, and everything he's in, he's fantastic in it.
Oh, I loved his big ears.
And I always forget his name. Wait, what's the name again?
Jamie Bell.
I loved his big ears in this.
I thought he was amazing in this.
He's fantastic, yeah. The acting is fantastic. Right, but let's first try and tell the story.
Just like a little bit.
Just a little bit.
It's basically two... Andrew Scott's character, Adam, is living in this big new block of flats in London.
It's very Ballardian.
Yeah, and you discover that there's basically no one else living there. They haven't moved anyone else in yet. The only other person living there is...
the beautiful Paul Mescal.
And they inevitably, you know, they see each other.
They have...
have the hots for each other.
Well...
and they start a romantic relationship.
Yeah. Well, it's crucial that the Paul Mescal character... what's his name? Don't know.
I don't know, actually.
He goes up to kind of proposition Adam.
Yeah.
And Adam says no.
At first. That's not to do with not fancying him, though, right? That's about dating the only person that's in your building.
Yeah, but he says no.
And also he's drunk.
Well, there's a few reasons why.
I don't think that's not to do with physical attraction.
No, I don't think that's... I don't know. But
it would be hard. Find me a person on this earth
who would...
wouldn't consider having...
But Paul Mescal in this film is... well, we can come to this later, but he's not like the sexy, you know.
No, he's vulnerable and messy.
He's very vulnerable and messy.
And that is sexy.
It is. And he's like a cardigan wearing kind of vibe.
Yeah, grown out beard sort of vibe. anyway, they meet. You carry on, take the next thread of the story. Is a screenwriter.
Adam's a screenwriter, and you see that he's working on a film that is set in the 80s in suburbia. We realise that it's based on his childhood. As part of research, he goes back to his childhood home.
Which is in the suburbs, just outside London. Yeah.
And he discovers his parents still living in the house. Still the ages that they were when they died in a car crash when he was 12 years old.
And that's unclear. When he first, you know that he's gone to somewhere, you think he's gone, you're pretty sure he's gone home, but in the film, when he first sees them, you don't know that they're his parents. You think that you're confused by what the relationship is because they seem very fond of each other and it's got this slightly uncanny feeling to it.
Yeah, and especially because the first time you see his dad, played by Jamie Bell, it looks like he's going cruising.
Yeah.
So he's in like this...
which I thought was really interesting.
Yeah, there's this like head nod that happens. So Adam follows him through the bush and into this like this corner store. And then you gradually realise, oh, they know each other. And then they go back to his house.
Yeah.
And then Claire Foy is there, who's his mum.
So it's essentially a ghost story.
Yeah.
But without the sort of, like, conventions of a horror film. A haunting without the horror. There is some horror.
There are moments of horror, yeah.
My main concern was you didn't know if you were watching him go crazy or not.
Yeah.
That's the thing that I found disconcerting, is the idea that he's completely made it up. And I was actually really relieved when the film actually doesn't conclude that he's made it up. That it's like, it's a real thing that's happening in his world, rather than...
It's what makes it beautiful, actually.
I felt sort of like, I was really tense, because like, I'm imagining suddenly it's showing us what he's really doing.
Yeah, and it never does that.
And him being like, either on his own in a field, having a freak out. At one point, I thought it might have like... young children involved. I was like, what are we building up to here? Like, what is he actually doing? Yeah. And it was a beautiful relief to be like, that's not what the film is going.
I'd say the closest it gets to a moment where you're like, whoa, he's experiencing essentially psychosis, is when the love affair with this Paul Mescal character is unfolding, and he says, come with me. He like trusts him enough to be like, come and meet them. And obviously Paul's character, we really should find out his name. What's his name?
I want to say Danny, but I don't think that's right.
Harry.
Oh, Danny Harry. Boy. Close.
Harry. So, and Harry comes with him to see, you know, he's like, what is this?
He doesn't know where we're going.
And then you do see it through Harry's eyes, where Adam is basically knocking at this door and his parents won't come out. And then I'd say the moment that is most full of horror is when you see them appear in that dark window,
yeah,
in their night things. Oh my god, I'm getting scared just talking about it.
It was horrific,
yeah. But crucially,
but they're not scary.
They're not scary at all.
And I do think that's kind of beautiful. I do love ghost things that aren't about. Obviously, horror films play on the horror of death. Like that's like what's being played on all the time, is the threat of death. And so it is amazing to watch a film where no one needs to amp up the threat of death, because death is horrible enough. And actually what the ghosts serve is like a kind of grief and mourning, and it's about loss rather than the horror of dying. The horror of dying is like in the whole film, but as a sort of, in the sort of under hum that you have in your general life, rather than being like, this is horrific that someone's come back from the dead. It's like, this is kind of beautiful, it's and a beautiful. Rare opportunity. Like,
because what you see unfold, and this is why it's relevant to this podcast, is like the sort of temporal knot of when you're a gay person or a queer person growing up without a relationship to your parents because they died, so they never really knew the true you. And you never really knew what they would think of you.
Yes, so the queerness aspect. I haven't read the book, Strangers.
Well, let me tell you that queerness is only in the film. In the book, it's a straight couple. He starts an affair with a woman who lives in his building. And the same thing is true that his parents have died when he was younger, but it's not a queer story at all.
Wow.
Yeah. And I read an interview with the director-writer, Andrew Hay, where he said he thought that it really lent itself to a queer story, which I think is interesting in itself.
Is he queer?
Yes. And actually, I found this very interesting. The house in the film is the director writer's childhood.
Oh my god.
Home. Yeah. So it's a really personal story.
Wow.
Yeah.
That explains a lot, actually.
Yeah.
Okay, fascinating. Well, then I want to return to this idea of like, because there's another ghost that haunts the film, which is what Adam has lived through, Andrew Scott's character, which is like the AIDS crisis.
Yeah.
And like when he's first having sex with Harry. There's all this fear and nervousness, partly because he's lonely and he hasn't had like a romantic relationship in a while, but also I was reading into it like he was used to having, maybe the last time he was having frequent sex, there was all this fear around it, or it's like difficult to detach the act of
when,
like,
your formative sexual years were happening,
like death and love
time.
Are like really connected. And if you're growing up in the 80s and you had all those haunting adverts on about AIDS with the gravestone,
and around the time that his own parents died,
it's being confined to small groups, but it's spreading, so protect yourself.
and read this leaflet when it arrives. If you ignore AIDS, it could be the death of you. So don't die of ignorance.
You could definitely read that other ghost onto the fact that they choose to introduce his dad almost like cruising.
Yeah.
Because it's almost like
a linking.
There's a linking there in a way that feels... You can either make it like... You can either interpret sort of like Oedipal vibes mm-hmm. of like attraction to his dad, but that doesn't feel quite right in the rest of the film. Although there's like a really deep bond there. There's something there. So it's almost like sex for Adam's character is also kind of a haunting.
Mm. Interesting.
Like that there's another... To compare the death of his parents with cruising is like to make a link between two formative losses, maybe, which is like... the loss of being able to, or never feeling able to have sex in a way that was like free. But I did think that was an interesting choice. And it also made you think for the rest of the film that his dad does have a knowledge of his queerness. Because the way that they meet has got this like sexual charge on it because you don't know what the relationship is. And there's this sort of leading him. And without then, talking to him.
Yeah, and then there's that moment where there's a beautiful conversation between the mum and Adam in bed. And when he turns over to look at his dad, it's turned into Harry.
So there's that, I guess there's that also connection then between... There's a conversation between Adam and his dad, which is about the fact that Adam's dad never knocked on the door when he could hear Adam crying as a child.
Yeah.
Part of the beauty of the relationship between Andrew Scott and Paul Mescal, Adam and Harry, is that they are very vulnerable with each other and they do cry into each other. So there is this like...
Yeah.
There's this like, the love in that relationship is healing or serving or repeating the love that was absent from the relationship with his father.
Now I think that it is important to talk about the ending then.
Okay.
Because how you interpret the ending really changes how you interpret that relationship.
Okay, so...
But I think we might have very different understandings of the end.
They can't visit him anymore. They stop, like, they die again. And then Adam goes back to the office, the big tower block building, and discovers that Harry has killed himself.
Yeah.
And then, moments later, he meets Harry's ghost.
Yeah. So this is where...
interpretations come in.
Yeah, so he picks up the whiskey bottle, which is one of the reasons that Harry is dead.
Yeah.
He's drunk himself to death.
Yeah.
And it's the same whiskey bottle from the first night. And he's in the same outfit.
Oh!
He's in the same outfit as that first night that he propositioned him. So my interpretation is that he died that night when
that
Adam
makes
said
sense,
no
actually,
to him.
Yeah.
And it also makes sense of the fact that we're led to believe his body is...
old.
Decomposing. So that means that all of that intimate, beautiful relationship was playing out with a ghost as well.
Oh my God. Yeah, that's obviously it. I just didn't think that at all.
Yeah.
I hadn't caught that at all.
And
he's in the same jumper.
That makes it even more heartbreaking. It was one of the reasons why I almost felt like cheated. Because that was the hope of it, right? That was the hope of the story, is that he was being let go by his parents because he'd found some love and some consistency and had allowed himself to be loved by another person. And that, and then it's kind of the equivalent of being told like, oh, it was all a dream. And it was. But then that final... There is still something really beautiful about that. The final decision, I guess, is that he gives himself over to loving this ghost. Like, they lie together. But it's tragic. For me, it just casts the whole thing as such a tragic story.
I did reach a point where I was like, this feels like too much. As in, like, I'm now beyond, why does this have to be this much despair?
Yeah.
I don't feel up for it. I've just given actually quite a lot of my emotional capacity to that scene with. And then it sinks even further to be like, this person is totally alone. And I was like, I do not want that to be the end of the story. And I know that in some ways they're not alone, because then it cuts to the stars or whatever.
I know, but they are in a real sense alone.
They are in a real sense alone, and he's like totally on his own.
Yeah,
and
so
I just,
for me, like,
I just couldn't bear it.
So I think that you can look at something as like a beautiful film. Like, it's a beautiful work of art.
It's a beautiful
film.
Some
of the shots are incredible. The soundtrack. And then be like, I don't agree with what it's saying about queerness. I agree with what it's saying about a certain kind of generation of gay man that is like, you know, clearly that's from a lived experience of the writer and director. Like, using his childhood home, he's saying a very personal thing that will resonate with a lot of people, and that's tragic. But when you have two gay main characters, and one of them is terribly alone, and the other one is gay and alone, not because his parents are dead, but because his parents don't understand him, and it ends with that one drinking himself to death, and he's meant to be the kind of millennial representative in that story, you know, a different generation who didn't live through the, like, AIDS panic. It's terribly depressing. And it's really bury your gaze-y. And, like, if you're going to do it beautifully, which is this. But
the tricky thing is, right, like, obviously we're queers and we go to a queer film. We really want it to, we want to be seen by it, and there's a sort of mutual seeing that we want to happen. We want to feel seen and by it, and we want it to see us. Like, and that's a sort of, it's a heavy thing to bring into, it's actually quite a lot of expectation to bring into a cinema, and that means that there's so much room for disappointment. Like, I find myself, if I hear
so
that a show,
higher.
If I hear about a show that's on, or a book, or like, I actually often quite avoid things that have queer in the title, because I'm like, if a particular, unless I've heard it's amazing, because I don't want to be disappointed by a bad version of something that I care about.
Yeah.
But then in this scenario, right, you go with this thing, which is like, it's a queer romance, and then therefore you're expecting it, you're reading into it like a representation of queers everywhere, rather than maybe more truthfully what it is, and what I think is revealing about the fact that it's set in his actual childhood home, which is like a very vulnerable, tender, like, fictional biopic vibe, like a sort of myth, biomythography or something. As we've said before, Elle and I are not the most regular of content producers. However, that just means that we appreciate the people that support us on Patreon even more, because they allow us to be the messy selves that we are and create the work that we love and support queer makers in the process. It means so much to us if you support our podcast. You can support us at patreon.com/lifeofbi. We're not looking for a lot, just the price of a cup of coffee or a pint a month makes a huge difference and means that we can keep going with this podcast. Thank you so much. Bye.
Yeah, I think you're totally right. The bar is like, is too high.
And I get, so because, and also because of the burial gaze trope, there's a sort of disappointment in the fact that it doesn't work out. But I also, I really don't want every queer thing I see to be like,
to be
happy, clappy, it's all right.
No, you're right.
And that also gets fucking boring after
it's
a while.
True.
That's why I hate sex ed. It's like, oh my God, you're also fucking happy about everything.
Yeah. And
like, all these problems.
You're also good at communicating.
Yeah, it's like,
no, I totally agree. And I think it is like, hoisted by its own petard. Does that work here, that phrase?
I don't know what that means.
Because, like, my experience of watching it in isolation was that I was like devastated by its beauty. I loved, and I do think that the way that it used time and fantasy was so queer. Like, the film itself, I think, does feel so queer, like, formally, because you just have to accept that, like, these weird things with time are happening. And by the end of the film, like, there is that feeling of the back of your brain opening up and, like, a telescopic lens falling out, because, like, it's bending your understanding of reality and how we relate to people, and that I really respect. And it did feel like formally so interesting and queer and like unexpected and bold and weird.
I totally agree.
And that I really love about
What's his name, the one that wrote it's basically like death to the child. Who's that queer theorist?
Oh, Edelman.
Yes, Lee Edelman. And what's that book called? No Child, No Future.
Oh, right.
Death to the Child.
Death Drive?
No Future, that's what it's called.
Yes, No Future.
Yeah. And he's sort of like trying to deconstruct the drive. It's almost like you could also kind of call it kind of a conservative drive or a procreation drive, which is like obsessed with looking after the children. And you see that in loads of conservative logic, protect the children. Like children are brought into like basically anything where white people want to win about something.
Yeah.
Like, or like white mothers or like some sort of group with power. You can do anything. You can do horrible things on behalf of children.
Yeah.
And he's sort of being like, deconstruct that child. Queers are not about the future. Mm. You're moving into life without like an obsession with leaving, which isn't obviously it's a theory. It's not. And it's incredibly wordy and I haven't read all of it. So I'm probably butchering it now. But I guess I'm seeing a link here because there's this like uncanny thing where he's older than his parents.
Yeah.
So there is this, he's childlike in those scenes, but there is this folding of time, which feels quite queer, where it's not about the future at all. It's all about the past.
Yes, yeah.
And he's way more embedded in the past than he is about moving forward. And he actually seems happy with, he's very happy being with his people in the past.
Yes.
The loss.
Yes, and in
that feeling at the end of tragedy.
Mm.
It's from the fact that, like, we know, the viewer, that the person he's in love with is a ghost. And so we just can't imagine how this could end in a good way.
This is why, like, you're so right to bring up that as a lens to view it through. Because then, through that lens, that final shot is, it really is beautiful because it's a denial of the future.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, we will be present here.
Should I get up a quote? In this searing polemic, Lee Edelman outlines a radically uncompromising new ethics of queer theory. His main target is the all-pervasive figure of the child, which he reads as the linchpin of our universal politics of reproductive futurism. Edelman argues that the child, understood as innocence in need of protection, represents the possibility of the future against which the queer is positioned as the embodiment of a relentlessly narcissistic, antisocial, and future-negating drive. He boldly insists that the efficacy of queerness lies in its very willingness to embrace this refusal of the social and political order. In No Future, Edelman urges queers to abandon the stance of accommodation and accede to their status as figures for the force of a negativity that he links with irony, jouissance, and ultimately the death drive itself.
How interesting.
It's actually a really good lens.
That's a great lens to understand it. However, if we're to look at that, if we're to look at the film through that lens and we understand that, like, it's a rejection of, like, family norms, then that's true. Like, Adam's character talks about the fact that all his friends have moved out into the suburbs to have gardens for their kids. But it doesn't undermine, it doesn't, like, change the fact that there's, like, two people living in this building and they're both gay and they're both isolated in this tower. And they're both lonely. And, like, I think Edelman's theory is that that's like a form of liberation. But this, in this film, it's like an incarceration, the way they're living, high up above all of the rest of the city, detached from it. It's like a new suburbia, actually. And that's what I found myself thinking watching it, all those high rises in Stratford.
Oh my God, the view from his window.
Fuck, that first image.
Oh.
And you know, even that first image, there's something ghost-like about him there.
Yes.
Because you're looking
Maybe
at this...
he's dead as well.
Well, there is that fire alarm right at the top, you know. Maybe they all die. Maybe they all die in a fire. No, but there's that, it's that image where he sort of appears above the city.
Is the idea that that generation of gay man is sort of like a ghost in our culture?
I think so.
That they carry all this trauma that is buried or hard to imagine for young queers now.
Yeah.
And so they are almost like walking memorials
to a
of that time.
Yeah.
And it's true that, like, who talks about this? So it's Bessel van der Kolk, who wrote that very famous book, actually, The Body Keeps the Score.
Mm-hmm.
all mind, brain and body in the transformation of trauma. And he was working with Vietnam vets and realizing that these men that had seen these horrible things done to their friends or seen their friends die, that one of the reasons they couldn't move on was because they felt that they had to, that they were the only thing keeping those people alive, and that if they forgot them, they really truly died. And so it was like working with their trauma was about acknowledging that they can let go, that there's like really guilt about letting go of this thing, so that these bodies become living memorials of another person, that trauma like can turn a living person into sort of holding the ghosts of other people and feeling like it is your duty to carry these ghosts through your life.
Survivor
and never let
guilt.
Them go. Yeah. And never let them go. And it reminded me of that as well, which is like this, like keeping this person alive in you. Okay, two final things I want to chat about, which is there's the loneliness, there's deep loneliness in it. Is there a counter to the loneliness? Because obviously it ends on... it's very sweet. They're spooning. Ghost spooning is the last sort of image. And then they've sort of, they turn into, sort of get further and further away from them, and they turn into a star in the sky. But that final image of all the stars together is actually an image of company, but in a more celestial, spiritual way, right? Which is that there's company in loneliness, and that's the image, which is like he's not alone. He might not have loads of friends, but it seems to try and rescue that loneliness by being like, there is companionship with everyone that's died, with other lonely people through the ages, with his parents, that there is this, again, time collapsing community that is to do with ties and links and bonds beyond like the daily quotidian relationship with another body in person.
And I think it, what, and a point you made earlier is really crucial to that, which is that you never see Adam from the outside lens of someone who has like lost his mind or is imagining things. And I think that is really important because the whole story is truthful. Those people are real in the story. Like, there's no...
That's a real thing that happened
to him. There's no apparition.
Yeah.
And there's no question about that. It's not like, you know, Banquo's ghost in Macbeth.
That would be... That would feel so wrong, innit? Because it would be, like, making him pathetic.
Making him judgment.
Yeah, on that sort of...
Yeah.
And I guess the stars thing, if you want to take it back to science again, like, we're all stardust.
We're all made of stardust.
We're all made of stars. So that is, like, kind of...
It's kind of true.
It's kind of true.
Yeah.
There is a truth to it, which is to be like, well, there's no such thing as a truly isolated body.
The bury your gaze thing, I'm also frustrated by the standards that we, like, hold a gay film up to. And I think that, like it has to speak for everyone, or, you know, it has to be like this perfect representation of queerness. But I think there is something to the fact that the book that it's based on is not a queer story, and that the same story of loneliness makes total sense whether those characters are gay or not. There's obviously an extra layer added to this one, which is the extra ghost that you said of, like, the AIDS crisis.
But it's just important to be like, it's not so much a comment on, like, queerness, but just on Andrew Hay. And I feel like, you know, we're like trying to write a queer thing at the moment, and you're going to sort of hamstring queer artists if the pressure when you're making a thing is that it's got to be representative of everything. Like, you're actually taking away one of the main things about creativity, which is it comes from personal experience. And like, that is the fruit, that is like where all creativity comes from. So to then have to meet all of these other standards about like what films should be representing about queerness, if that's not coming from a true place for you, you might as well not do it. It's what can you do that's true? And queer loneliness is a truth in the same way that queer companionship is a truth. So that this shouldn't necessarily be a value judgment on which is represented in a film. I thought it was beautiful, and I also thought the maybe it's because they're both hot. But I don't think it is quite that. I thought the way that the first kiss was filmed, like, I felt a thrill from my cunt to my neck vibes. Yeah. Like, it, yeah. I felt
it
like overtaken.
Sexy.
I was overtaken with the impulse of it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I was like, that is brilliant filmmaking.
Yeah. I wrote down, do you want to know what I wrote in my notes there?
What? I came.
In capital letters, I've written thighs. I'm sorry, but if Paul Mescal is a ghost there and they're managing to fuck like that, I say go off. Stay with the ghost.
What's go off mean? Die?
No. Like, do your thing. Stay with the ghost.
Yeah, if it's possible to have that great sex with a ghost.
If you're going to get fucked so well by a ghost, stay with him.
Yeah.
Like, nothing needs to change. So it's a happy ending. Life of Bi was made, edited, and hosted by us, Elle Potter and Mary Higgins.
Sound design and production by Tom Foskett Barnes.
This podcast is supported by you, the listener. Special thanks this month to Camilla, Kate, and May.
You can join them by supporting us at patreon.com/lifeofbi.
I just want to say, and it ain't over till the bisexual speech.